we have here. The view is, now this is a view from the summit of Black Mesa. And
Black Mesa Phantom.
Now this is the wide canyon. We went east on this wide canyon. You see, here's my guide with me.
Mm-hmm.
And as we went up there, we passed this arch.
Mm-hmm.
And inside of this was a couple of small cliff dwellings. Here, this one. This was one of them.
Uh-huh.
And I asked this boy, I said, will you please get inside so I can take your picture?
Yes.
And he said, "Don't dust it, kiss me, dust it." "No, my friend, I'm afraid." "I come out this fence," I said. "Joe, and I saw the beach here, he dies about it." And I said, "Don't dust it, kiss me, dust it." "No, my friend, I'm afraid." "Why are you afraid?" "And Asazi Bichini Bhajan." And Asazi are the ancient people. The evil spirits of the ancient people are dangerous. And I said, "Hat Ash Bhajan. Jotego Nishi. They'll strangle you at night while you sleep." So I said, "All right, now I'll set up my camera here and I'll go inside and you press this button for me." "Well, that's all right." "Yes, he'd do that. But he wouldn't go inside."
Yes,
so that's me.
Oh, what do you know?
And this is Black Mesa at a distance.
Mm-hmm.
And along the edge of Black Mesa was this very interesting character. He was 117 years old when I took that picture.
Grandfather, when Kit Carson captured the Navajos in 1863.
This girl here was one of the girls that lived with John S. and Lone Beginning. She was his daughter. Now, this was a narrow canyon. You see how narrow it is here?
Mm-hmm.
And this must be about 200 feet. And back here you have a cave. And on top of Black Mesa there was no good water. It was all heavily mineralized. And so bad they had to haul their drinking water up there. So we went back there and we found a good sized pool, a spring, right in that cave. And we tasted it, and it was good, sweet water.
Mm-hmm.
And this boy said he didn't know that spring was there. He'd never been up there. It was the only good water on Black Mesa.
And they didn't know it was there?
He didn't know it was there. So I found the cliff ruin. This map will show you the location.
Mm-hmm.
And I've got a couple of views of it here. There were over 100 buildings in it.
Oh.
Four kivas, the round ceremonial chambers.
Yes, I know what the kivas are.
And I took some samples of pottery. Now, I found very few pottery fragments, and I could see at a glance what had happened there. Probably because of drought, but for some reason, the whole populace deserted the village gradually. And there were three or four buildings with roof timbers on them, and all the rest had the roof timbers removed, and they were partly demolished. Now, I don't think anyone had been up there since the people that built it had left.
Mm-hmm.
And they had just gradually demolished the buildings.
In time, probably.
Yes, deserted, they abandoned it gradually. Well, mm-hmm. I was the first one to see it, I think, after the last people had left. So that's the story I wrote. I finally found it 13 years after.
13 years, yes.
After I heard of it.
All right, well, I'll take
so
this.
So I thought you'd like to know the story.
Yes, I'll take these two. Well, I've got my reading cut out for me tonight.
And this, of course.
Yes, the canyon.
Grand Canyon. And
all
this.
Right, and this is the story.
Now,
I
think I've finished everything I want to tell you tonight.
All right.
So, whatever I needed. No, I made it a rule to have no more than 10 or 12 in a class.
Yeah.
The authorities there, the powers that be in the Marine Corps, left this entirely in my hands,
mm-hmm.
so I could do it any way I liked. I wanted to...
Now, was this at Pendleton?
Camp Pendleton.
Yes.
I wanted only a few in the class so they could be very closely supervised,
mm-hmm.
and be helped. 8 weeks was just barely enough time for them to get, and they had to work hard to do it. Mm-hmm. So the smaller the class, the faster they could go, you see.
Did they have any other military drill or anything of that sort?
Oh, yes. They had gone through boot camp. I think that was an eight-week course.
It was preceding
the to get their basic training. They came in as raw recruits. They got their uniforms, and they were taught to march into the different formations and got their basic military training. Then they came over and took the eight-week course for code talkers. And then I sent in the list of names for warrants for private first class. Mm-hmm. And then they left. They were assigned to different units for communication.
Then after, that's the phrases, after the end of your first class, you took some of those, you kept some of those to teach the next classes that came in. Then. And then this was self-perpetuating then, was it, sort of?
Yes, the ones that I thought were the most adept, who could handle men best, who were temperamentally suited to teaching.
Yes.
I'd select enough to keep the recruits that were coming in, you see.
That's right.
Now, I had some notice as to what to expect. I would get reports on how many were in boot camp.
Oh,
I
see.
How many were coming up,
course.
You see.
Yes, but was it pretty steady? I mean, they would just come out of boot camp and come to you, and it was, I mean, it kept going.
Yes.
Most of the time.
Yes.
And then this went on for 2 years, and at the end of that time, that
Not entirely 2 years.
Uh-huh.
The dates, I enlisted the 1st of October 1942, early in October, and I went on recruiting duty until November, and late in November I got my first class. And then from that time on, I had my Navajo code talker section there, training the recruits as they came in, until about August of 1944. And by that time we ran out. It took me about a month to get a discharge.
Yes.
So I was discharged in September. So it was about 2 or 3 months short of 2 years.
Now, as I have read this, all these things, Navajo Times and so forth, there is a little discrepancy in the number of men who were code talkers. One place there were 420, another was 380 or something like that. Do you know?
I can't give you any information
All right.
on that.
All right.
Your best bet is to contact, the Navajo Times, I guess, is reliable. I kept no record of the number. Mm.
Well, it's all right.
So,
I don't need to have it exact. I just thought maybe if you knew.
No, I don't.
Now, here is something that has nothing to do, really, with the code. But in my reading, I found that Ernie Pyle, at one time, referred to the fact that the Indians, the Navajos.
I have his book in which you mentioned it.
Yes, how they had a war dance and so forth.
We got a personal letter from Ernie Pyle, too.
Uh-huh.
Somewhere
well,
in
now,
my books,
I wondered
I
if
that.
You know, I have that one incident. Do you know of any other instance? Of course, you weren't in combat with them, of course, but I just wondered if you knew of any time when they carried any of their old Indian customs into the combat area in any way.
No, I can't recall any such
right.
references that.
Okay, well, it may be that...
Except for one program we gave to Camp Elliott. That's before we moved to
yes.
Camp Pendleton. And I got that up. I conceived the whole thing, and we put on a show one night. It was quite an elaborate show. And Martin Link has a picture of some of the boys that participated in that in their costumes.
Oh.
And one of my best instructors, Jimmy Kelly King, and for the occasion he wrote this. Now here's the way it goes. that first verse and follow me. Nehokene eh anahila asogono vases kai. Nepakajido kakaji asogono da deepa. Setada anine eya ebe nihi hozin. Washington bakaspa kosina jilino bahojo.
Jimmy King did this.
Yes, Jimmy King.
Now he did it for that, for the shindig that you had at the at Camp Elliott.
At Camp Elliott. And in that connection, it seems to me that you'd almost need some personal stories from them.
But that's what I hope to get.
Yes.
Do you think I'm having a difficulty? Do you think they'll talk to me? I'm standing
I think you'd better, you better work through Martin Link. I think he knows them.
Yes.
He either knows now when I worked in the trading post. Mm. Just to show how far they carry that custom. I'd seen two women, or a woman, would be in the store sitting on the floor. And another woman would come in. She'd go and sit on, across the room, another spot, squat down on the floor. They'd sit there for 10 or 15 minutes. Then one would go up and the other go to the other, and they'd put their arms around each other and cry because they were so happy to see each other. They hadn't seen each other for years. They'd have to wait 5 or 10 minutes.
Now,
the Navajo, you've seen pictures of the Hogans with the blanket hanging over the door.
Yes.
You don't
Their houses are usually circular, aren't they?
Yes.
With,
like the wigwam.
Yes.
No, not like the wigwam.
The wigwam is conical. Some Hogans are conical, almost like a wigwam, with the door coming out the side. Yes, is that
what kind of a roof do they have? Regular?
Well, the dirt, they cover their logs with chips and brush and so on to make them dirt proof, and then they cover them over with dirt.
Yeah.
And it makes a very snug
house. Do they have dirt floors? Or are they,
Oh, yeah, dirt floors. They never have anything but dirt floors.
Well, let's see. Can you think of any questions, Wilson?
You don't knock on the door before you go in. You just look over the blanket to see who's inside. And they know someone's there, they see who it is. And you look for a little while, maybe 10 seconds or so, 15. And then you walk in and find a place to sit down and say nothing. You don't go around and say hello, you don't speak to anybody. You go in and sit down. And after you've sat there 5 or 10 minutes, you get up and go shake hands all the way around.
I'm glad to be your dentist.
Well,
take that much time with everybody. And they still do that.
Yes, I know those missionaries cast as many an envious eye at me. They only wished they had my vocabulary. And just think of all the souls that have gone to hell because of my stubbornness and not wanting to preach the gospel to them.
Oh, dear.
Well, I know on several occasions I interpreted for court. I was a court interpreter.
Oh.
And I interpreted once for the grand jury in Prescott. And that's quite a story, too, if we have time for it sometime.
Mm-hmm.
That was quite a comedy, finally. But now you have certain questions. Let's concentrate on those.
I brought down the wrong little book. This is just a write-in. I have another one very much like it.
I think the educated Navajos and those who have been around in white settlements a long time, they lose that, I think. Of course, you understand this. There is a great deal, or I'll put it this way. My knowledge of that dates back about 50 years, and I haven't kept up with developments out there. Mm-hmm. Now, another custom they had that was very ludicrous was, and this is a custom which you might approve, after a man was married, he was never supposed to look at his mother-in-law, and vice versa. If they looked at each other again, full in the face, they'd both go blind.
The mother-in-law?
Yes. And I have seen, when I worked in the trading posts, and down there I'd see an Indian woman, she'd catch a glimpse of her son-in-law approaching. She'd let out a scream, she'd throw herself face down on the ground and cover her head with her blanket like that, so she wouldn't see her son-in-law.
I have to tell George about this tomorrow.
And in 1901, when we went back to Washington, one of the side products of that trip was a $5,000 appropriation to build a dam and irrigation system. And we had a force of Navajos digging the ditch and building this dam. And a Navajo died and was buried by my people, our people. My father and uncle went out and buried him. And the next day, on the job, somehow the word got around that the shovel which had buried this Navajo had been brought back to this job. And one Navajo said to the other, you're using that shovel that buried that man yesterday. So this man dropped it like it was red hot, and he reached down and picked up sand and rubbed his hands in the sand to get the thingy off his hands.
What is that word? How do you spell it?
C-H-E-N-D-I. Now I'm spelling it phonetically.
Yes.
Chindi. Chindi. C-H-E-N-D. Chindi. Chindi. Well, we called it Chindi.
And that is the spirit of the dead.
Chindi is evil spirit.
Evil spirit. That's right.
Which brings up the subject of Navajo profanity. They don't have profanity that is a counterpart of ours. They don't use the names of divinity, for example.
No.
Their profanity consists, the strongest expression they have is chi. Then they have mai, which is coyote, shush, jishcha is grave, dead is from the grave. Some evil thing from the grave. Keesh, snake. That is the sum total of their profanity. And I was making a tour with some of my friends on the reservation many years ago, and I was explaining this profanity to them. We were sitting by a Navajo hogan, and they swear at their dogs to have to drive them away, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So, there was a dog not far away from us, and I said, now, in the order of their potency, it would be shush, would perhaps be that's bear, shush. That would be about the most innocuous of all the terms. Shush and mai is about the same. Keesh is a little stronger. Chini is very strong. When they say that.
What is the second one? The first one means bear, and the second one means what?
Shush.
Bear.
Mai, coyote. Keesh, snake. And how they can get that out when they're mad. Keesh. Keesh. And this dog was lying down not far away, and so I said, now I'll demonstrate. So I said, my. The dog got up. Shush. He started to walk away. Sheesh. He started to trot. Chee. He started to run like this. He knew each stage of focusing. We got a little higher. Now, after Cheney, if he didn't get out of the way, the next would be a rock. Our culture and their ancient culture.
Yes.
There'll be somewhere in between. And all that I'm telling you about the Navajos are the original old time people. And
no.
not the educated ones.
Now, I read the other day something about the fact that the Indian young people who are at the universities and so forth suffer quite a lot. The people say, how I squaw. I mean, they're just nasty, you know. And for some of these young Indians and the universities are just as bright and alert and as smart as any of our people, and it's a disgrace. Now look, here's a question that I have here that makes me think of another. Do they have a good sense of humor? Or they always look so quiet and sort of stolid? I mean, when I see them, do they ever think things are really funny?
Well, their sense of humor is different from ours. They're not so volatile. They're not so. They don't like smart alecks.
Well, I don't
and they're very self-contained. They have their own sense of humor, but it isn't the same as ours.
Do they laugh?
Oh yes, sure.
Yeah. Uh-huh. All
much
right.
As anybody else. But now I've got a couple of stories. This story could possibly be apocryphal. I didn't witness this myself. But it came to me on pretty good authority. Some of these Navajos that you see that look like natives, that is, illiterate Navajos, just as savage as all the rest of them, might deceive you. They might be more than they appear to be. This case, which I think was authenticated, some smart aleck from the outside, some tourist, went into a trading post. And he was making a lot of wise cracks around, and there was one Navajo standing there in a very impassive way, and so he pulled a cigar out of his pocket and went up to him and he said, "Heap big chief, smoke." This Navajo said, "Belagana be chini." Belagana is American. Be chini. It's a rough translation would be to hell with the Americans. So this man turned around and said to the trader, "What did he say? What does that mean?" Well, there was a Navajo blanket spread out, or rug spread out on the counter, which this tourist had been examining. And he was considering buying this blanket. And he'd alternate between examining that and discussing it and turning around and making some wisecrack. And this happened to be a wisecrack right in the course of the deal to buy the blanket. So the trader didn't want to stir up any hard feelings. He wanted to keep this potential customer in good humor, you know. So he said, "Well," he just, his way of saying, "thank you, I appreciate it," or something like that. And you can imagine the consternation of both of them when this illiterate Navajo over there said, "I beg your pardon, I said nothing of the kind." Been through college, so you can't tell who they are.
Did they have any trouble adjusting to discipline of the Marine?
Oh, no. They took to it like ducks to water, but only because I used a certain gimmick to have them do it. And that's quite a story. Navajos are very independent. They're the type of people whom you would normally expect to not resist discipline, that's too strong. To be mentally, psychologically unfitted for it, I'll put it that way. So I gave each of my classes several lectures. Now this could go into the story. I said, now you are a few Navajos among a great throng of Pelicana. And incidentally, that word Pelicana is a corruption of the Spanish word Americano, American. Mm-hmm. The Navajos can't pronounce the letter R. And the nearest they can come to it is L. So it's Pelicana is American. It's a corruption of the Spanish word. And the same with gold. Gold in Spanish is oro.
Yes.
In Navajo, it's ola.
I see.
So they can't pronounce R. Well, I would tell them this. You are a small group of Navajos surrounded by a large number of Pelicana. Now, I said, you call the Hopis, in your language, Isquisani, those who live in villages. The Cahuillas in California are Beasaatsai, those who make the big bucks. The White Mountain Apaches, Zechila, those who live on top of the mountain. But Navajo is Dene, the people. The people. You are the best of all of them. And you can be the best in this camp and demonstrate to these Pelicana that the Navajos are better than they are. And the way to do it is to march better than they do. To make up your quarters a little bit cleaner, a little neater than the Pelicana do. Conform to the rules with more precision, do things a little more right than the Pelicana does, and you will get credit for it. And you know, it paid off handsomely. In fact, it was so obvious that the Navajos were better in every way that one Saturday after inspection, Major Sullivan called me in the office and gave me a memorandum, and he said, I want you to read this to your class. And it says, the commanding officer commends the Navajo school for the neatness of their quarters during the inspection. So I got them in formation and read that to them.
How do you spell Pelicana? Is it?
Oh, it's just
B-E-L-I-C-A-N-A.
Spell it phonetically. Listen to the word and spell it any way you can remember it. Pelicana.
Well, I was B-E-L-I-C-A-N-A.
It could be either P or B. It's sort of between the two.
Pelicana.
Uh-huh. And I know a lieutenant stopped me one day and he said, how do you make those Navajos march so well? He said, you know, usually most formations here, and Marines are supposed to be the elite. Okay. Most formations here, as they march, when the heel hits the pavement, there's just a fraction of a second for all heels to get on that pavement. But he said, the fraction of the second with the Navajos is much shorter than the others, and I noticed the difference. You know, they tried harder, that was it. They had more pride, more esprit de corps. And it was a great inspiration to me to work with people like that who responded as they did, and who got all these commendations. They certainly were superior to the white men. And coming from the camps and from the backcountry and doing that, I think was a great achievement on their part.
Did they get along well with the other Americanos?
Yes, they were mutually.
They were accepted.
Mutually. Oh, they. Yes. The white Marine just thought they were tops and vice versa.
Oh, that's great.
There wasn't any there's no race friction, but somehow the white men just marveled at the quality of these Navajos, the quality of everything they did.
And
they admired them.
When you were choosing the men, recruiting them, was there any particular method of recruiting them? I know that there was a proclamation in the Navajo Nation, you know, that asking the braves to recruit with the Marines for this purpose. Was there any particular gimmick, or was there any way that you...
Yes, we went out and hunted up all the educated Navajos we could get. And they were not too many of them. We had to go out and find them and find out how much schooling they'd had. They couldn't all do it. Those with two or three or four grades of school couldn't make the grade. They had to have, eight grades anyhow. And I had one or two college graduates. One was a teacher. And, I made him second in command. He took charge of things. When my father died and I went away for the funeral, he took over and, he was just excellent. Ross Haskey.
Did all of them make it, or did some of them drop out after you recruited?
I can't give you any figures on the failures, but they were very low.
Yes.
Not over 2 or 3%, maybe.
Mm-hmm. I think that.
And we had one that went bad. We had one was. I can only think of three, I guess. Jimmy King, that wrote the Marine Corps hymn,
yes,
was one of our problems. He was brilliant. He was capable. He was just ideal in every way, my best instructor. And so earnest, he wrote that Marine Corps hymn. But he simply couldn't resist the fire water.
I see.
And yeah. We just couldn't do anything with him. He'd be fine for 2 or 3 weeks. Then the next thing we knew, he'd be in the brig. Shore patrol had picked him up down on the street down in San Diego, and he just had way too much. So they brought him in. Well, we gave him restrictions. Of course, the top sergeant took care of that. I didn't take care of discipline problems that way. I turned him over to the top sergeant. I think that's a better way anyhow. I told him, I say, now here are the rules, and we expect you to follow them. And if they didn't, why, they were out of my hands. They went to the authorities then.
All right, now,
he came back, he told me, he said, I am absolutely through. He said, I'll never touch another drop. So he went to work, and he was splendid for 2 weeks. But the first sergeant said, now listen, the next time is the last. The next time you leave, you go overseas. So he did. That was it. Came in that last time, and everybody accepted the way he went.
Did they use the code talkers in all of the divisions? I believe there were six divisions, weren't there?
Oh, yes. They used them throughout the whole Pacific, yes.
Yes. And they, as I understand,
now,
they used them in teams, didn't they? Were they trained in teams, or were they a couple of after they were over in the combat area?
What were they? What?
Couple. I mean, assigned.
Oh no, they were interchangeable.
Interchangeable.
They had to be. They had to be interchangeable.
Well, I suppose so.
Yes. They had to be trained according to a certain uniform standard.
Yes.
So any code talker could fit in with any other code talker in the service. Uh-huh. It had to be that way. Otherwise, mm-hmm, the whole system would have broken down.
Oh, yeah, I can see that.
Now, in this last group of papers I gave to Martin Link, you'll find some information in there about assignments, how they assigned these, so many to a division.
Good.
Or to a brigade. Or
that's good.
You'll find a lot of correspondence in there. And among those letters, you'll find one written by General Clayton B. Vogel right after I took the four Navajos down to Camp Elliott from Los Angeles, and he gave them this trial on translating. Mm-hmm. He was very enthusiastic about the way they showed up, even under those conditions. Mm-hmm. And General Vogel, I think, was instrumental in getting it to service. He used all of his influence to get a favorable decision on trying it out.
I believe there was something about that in the, is it the Master Key in that story? One of those
yes,
stories
it's
that
mentioned.
I see.
It's mentioned,
yes.
But now, about Vogel, you might note this. There's one of those eight envelopes contains clippings and other news media that carried stories about the Navajo code. And there's one clipping about General Vogel with his picture. And it was written sometime after this, well, it was after, well, I think after I enlisted, it was about that time General Vogel gave a statement about the Navajos for communication. And he was very much for it. Copies from Coloma, and the post office had struck a special stamp showing Sutter's Mill. It was in the mill race that the gold was found. And this was, it was struck for just that one occasion. They didn't, use it. Well, it was sold in the post office for the centennial.
What date was that?
This is said January 24, 1948.
Yes, they postmarked it on the centennial.
Mm-hmm.
This consists of three articles I wrote about the mining country up there. These three. Now, this first one was the longest. There was 18,000 words in it and over 32 or three photographs.
The mother lode.
It runs 23 pages.
Yes. Yeah, 1 and 2.
And then this is the Northern Mines. It's an extension of the mother lode. Northward on the Sierras, and then the Trinity Mines is over near the coast in another range of mountains.
The second part of this is the Northern Diggins and the third, the Trinity Mines.
Yes, the second part. The Northern Mines, they call them the Northern Diggins.
Uh-huh.
North of the Mother Lode. And
the whole book will be
yes.
Lost and Living Cities of the California
mm-hmm.
Gold Rush.
Oh, I see.
The California Gold Rush. Yes.
Remember I mentioned what it says about it.
During World War II, perplexed Japanese decoders tried unsuccessfully to break down an American secret code that originated in northern Arizona. But they never found a key to unlock the Navajo language. And nearly a quarter century later, the men who served as Navajo code talkers have been honored by the government they served so well. One is Flagstaff's own George Kirk, who was among 21 Navajo Marine veterans attending the 4th Marine Division reunion recently in Chicago. Kirk, who has been with the Navajo Army Depot since January 16, 1946, was presented the American Indian Marine Award at the reunion for his services. The Marine veteran served as a Navajo code talker in the Asiatic Pacific area for more than 2 years and saw action against the Japanese on Bougainville, Guam, Iwo Jima, and the consolidation of the Solomon Islands. His newest award will join others he received during that conflict, including the Asiatic Pacific Campaign Medal, American Campaign Medal, Victory Medal, and Navy Unit Code Commendations Medal with 4 battle stars. I wouldn't exchange this experience for any in the world, Kirk said at the reunion. And his wife is no stranger to serving this country. Mrs. Kirk joined NAD even before Kirk on June 14, 1944. She worked for many years at the Depot Hospital serving as an interpreter and later became a nursing assistant. She remembers how astonished many of the Army doctors were over Navajo names like many turquoise, many goats, and so forth. Currently, Mrs. Kirk works as depot and telephone operator. And if that isn't enough, the Kirks also are the proud parents of this year's Powwow Princes. Their 19-year-old daughter, Gloria, was selected for the honor after an afternoon of competitive events in beauty, poise, horsemanship, and talent. All are fluent in the secret code the Japanese found impossible to crack. Now, I have that.
You have
that.
Bernice's book is the one I told you about. That my wife wrote.
Oh, Bernice is your wife.
Yes.
Oh, I see. I see. Well, the person, her book.
What did she say about it?
Well, she just, in her letter.
Yes.
She said, I hope this takes nothing from Bernice's book. Something like that.
I don't know how it could. Well, I don't know. It's just my father's work there, and
yeah,
a lot about my life out there.
Mm-hmm. Well, nobody would know better than she does. I'm glad it's being written up.
Mr. Claw, I noticed on jewelry and in some paintings and so forth, this symbol that's shaped a little bit like a horseshoe. Would you tell us if there is a, if it symbolizes anything in particular?
The only thing that it symbolizes are that the symbols more or less are stylized in reference to certain masks or other religious ceremonies that they have in the Navajo way, such as the 10-day or 9-day chant, depending upon what kind of ceremonial it covers. And the 9-day chant has symbols of various masses, and some of them are stylized after that same pattern.
You said something about blessing way.
Blessing way is a chant or a Navajo ceremonial to do good, or to it's more or less it has a psychological meaning of making things good with Mother Nature.
Oh, with one, that's good. Mm-hmm. All right, thank you very much.
And then that one symbol, what was it called? It's a Yebiches.
Yebiches.
How right. Do you spell that?
Tell me how that is. Well, can you approximate it?
Those that are in that area there are mostly made by commercial, using commercial dyes. And the ones that are in this area right through here are all vegetable dyes, meaning that they boil certain vegetations, and wool is dyed from that.
The vegetable dyes are much softer colors, aren't
right,
they?
Right, they're much softer, and they stay, and they're more lasting than the commercial dyes.
They don't fade,
right.
And of course, the designs are all definitely Navajo or Indian.
Chip, in fact, she's finishing up right now with that rug. They start from the bottom and come up to maybe a couple inches away from there, and then they start backwards from the top on down and come up. And then they leave a small seam through there, either at a corner. And most rugs are made that way, where there's an outlet symbolizing maybe to have bad spirits out.
Oh, I see.
So mm-hmm.
They do the whole thing with needles.
They don't do it. Just
the end.
Just at the end, mm-hmm. at the finished product there.
That's what I want.
Right.
Yes, this would take too long.
Oh, yes. It's on the loom.
But most of the work is done with that little weaving stick there. Ceremonials. You notice that they have the grinding corn chant, and they have the feather dance chant, and the fire dance, and Navajo dancers, and the Yebiches are way at the far end there, and these are the various type of ceremonials.
So you have one dance for the Yebiches,
right? Mm-hmm.
And that represents one of your primary ceremonials.
Right. That's probably one of the longest. Some take up to about 14 days, depending upon the sickness involved.
I see. Are these held for particular people or for on particular occasions? I mean, suppose you are sick, and then these are held to ask for your healing. Is that the way it is, or what? Does it take more than one person? Is it for the whole tribe,
No, it's individually, depending upon the diagnosis of, say, from a person that is in the, they usually get the recommendation either from a stargazer or somebody that takes a symptom of the sickness, and he would recommend a certain type of ceremonial. So, yeah, in case he said that you need the blessing away, then they'd have the Yeviche.
I see. Mr. Cannon mentioned the fact that, I think it was Mr. Cannon, maybe it was Mr. Johnston, that when a Navajo leaves the reservation, for instance, to go into battle, and he comes back, then there is a ceremony, can you tell me anything about that, to cleanse the effect of the outside world?
Yes, there is such a ceremonial, both when one is parting away from the reservation, and then after he associates with all types of other people, and then maybe that is a bad omen. They usually have another ceremony to cleanse all the evil spirits, and psychologically it helps out the person to forget what has happened in the past. And it's more or less a way of coming back to normal life. You're back on the reservation.
Yes.
That's what it amounts to.
That's
down here about 5 miles from St. Michael's. They call that the tea kettle. And it just looks like a kettle at a certain angle. You see the plastic.
Oh, yes,
out.
Yes.
And so it's your own painting.
It's beautiful.
Nice.
About here they wanted it. I got some other paintings that they want too, but they're not for sale.
Mr. Ayers says that he's painting too. Did you know that? Yes.
Yeah. It used to be sub-agencies, but they did away with this. The word sub-agency is strictly agencies now.